Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We have what's known in the United States as mass incarceration, which no other country in the world has. And I have been interviewing Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist from the Netherlands, and I've also interviewed Franz Kurz from Germany, who speak on the conditions and treatment in their countries compared to that in the United States. We also look at Norway, the role model of the penal system worldwide. Mariam is back with us today. In addition to our guests, Lieutenant Michael Johnson, a 14-year correctional officer who retired from the Montana Department of Corrections in early 2020. His experience involved working with people in the correctional center of both genders, ranging from the age of 13 years to 90. His extensive work experiences ultimately led to his writing a book, which he will get into shortly. Also on with us is Rhonda Champagne. And Rhonda is a licensed clinical social worker, therapist, who currently has her own practice, private practice, providing individual therapy. She was hired by the Montana Department of Corrections to assist with the implementation of a pilot project implementing a trauma-informed treatment program for adult female inmates. She previously spent many of her years working, even while in college, in community mental health centers, where she provided a multitude of services, including in the provisions of a day treatment specialist, case manager, a crisis intervention specialist, therapist, team leader, and eventually the director. So we are going to welcome our three guests, and we were going to learn more about the situations involving psychological issues in the penal system, the comparison between prisons in the U.S. and other countries, the treatment of the individuals incarcerated, and how Michael ultimately ended up writing this book, Correcting Treatment in Corrections. So, Mariam, do you want to stop briefly to introduce yourself, and then we will have Rhonda and then Michael introduce themselves as well?
Yeah, okay. In the Netherlands, I work with incarcerated people according my vision, which I call deeper justice. I also am writing a book about mass incarceration in the United States, and I especially try to see what's behind what we see. So how is the system built, and where is it rooted in? I'm at the end of my master's study philosophy, and I work also with people at home as a psychosocial therapist. That's me.
Thank you so much, Mariam. And Rhonda?
Thank you, Leona, for having us on your show. I appreciate that greatly. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I have a private practice here in Montana almost 5 years ago now. I was hired by the state of Montana to help implement the trauma treatment program for women who were imprisoned across the state, and we went in. Pardon me?
No.
Oh, okay. So going in there as a therapist, going into a prison system, because I had never been into a prison system before, but one of the things that I would like to say is that prior to going in there, I believed in the system. I believed that it, you know, was working for people. Once I got to the prison system and learned just how treatment isn't treatment, in at least in Montana, I can't speak of other places, but treatment is not treatment. What they call treatment is not treatment here in Montana. It is a prison system. And when we got in there, I was hired to implement a treatment program. We targeted women who have underlying trauma which leads to addiction. Addiction leads to crime. Crime leads to prison. These women were on their way out. They were coming into the community within a few months, and they stopped at the treatment program that I helped develop with Lieutenant Johnson and a whole bunch of other amazingly good people at Riverside. And we went in there, but when we first started, we learned pretty quickly just how hard it was and how difficult, because we had two different perspectives fighting with each other. But I'm happy to be on the show, and I'm glad to be talking about that. And I'll turn it over to Michael now.
Thank you so much, Rhonda.
Hi, my name is Michael Johnson, and I'm a former lieutenant for Montana Department of Corrections. As you stated, I've worked with incarcerated populations of both genders from the age 13 to 90. When I met Ms. Champagne, we were implementing the trauma-informed treatment program for adult women, and the experience compelled me and Rhonda to write this book. We co-authored it, and we wrote it to kind of educate people on the kind of conversations that a lieutenant in charge of the safety and security of the facility and policies and procedures from DOC would have with a trauma therapist and the culture of treatment, which don't go hand in hand. They're conflicting, to say the least. But we managed to get through it, and our program was extremely successful. And I really walked away seeing the incarcerated population, the women, very differently. I was kind of trained to prepare myself for manipulation and for violent behavior. And the trauma program kind of brought me into the treatment sense, and I really learned about what these women have been through, the traumas that they've been through, and it becomes very easy to understand how they can get involved with addiction and criminal behavior, and it really changed me.
I'll tell you, you mentioned that you don't know, I believe Rhonda mentioned, she doesn't know if it's the same in other states, but she was speaking on Montana. And as an advocate who has been advocating for the incarcerated men, women, and youth since 2004, it happens in every state. And I often say that I wish that all prisons were under the federal, because we have the same problems in every state, but the every state is different. It's so inconsistent. And these are some of the issues. And what you're talking about, Michael and Rhonda, is I appreciate what you're saying, because there are good and bad correctional officers, and there are good and bad officials in and out of the prison system, you know, even in law enforcement, in any form of any job. And what you're doing is what I admire, because what you're talking about is the treatment actually giving them, the incarcerated individuals, giving them the treatment that they need, not the abuses, not the deprivations or provocations, but actual treatment. And this is why I wanted to have you on the show, so that you could talk about exactly what you actually do to help. Because people on Facebook, they were from all over the country, and I belong to many, many groups on Facebook, and I'm sure that you are aware of these things, that are from around the country, that are crying over the treatment that their loved ones are getting. And so these things that you're talking about is very vital to them as well. So, Michael, why don't we get back into how you and Rhonda began or came up with the idea to write the book, and some of the issues that you might see, you know, that the individuals are in need of, the treatment, and some of the issues that go on within the penal system.
Yeah, sure. What we're advocates for, trauma-informed treatment. Trauma-informed treatment in a correctional facility under those prison policies and procedures, again, is very conflicting. So in the beginning, Rhonda and I did not get along. We came from opposite directions. For example, strip searches. She insisted that we could not do strip searches in a trauma-informed treatment program. And, of course, myself from DOC policies and procedures and my training, so absolutely, we have to have strip searches. in our program, we never did do a strip search. I lost that battle. And I'll tell you, the women respected it so much. They valued the fact that we didn't make them go through that strip search. I really found a higher level of safety and security on the unit than if we did have the strip search. They really appreciated it to such a high value.
I'd like to kind of jump in and say that from a clinical perspective, we, you know, when I was hired, we spent about 3 months. What happened is the prison system that I went to, one, was a prison system for youth girls, but the population had dwindled. The incarcerated youth population had dwindled to the point that the state of Montana was looking for a different program, and they decided to implement a trauma treatment program for women. They had learned that of many women, and I think men too, I don't think it's exclusive to men, have trauma that ends up leading them into prison. And so we went into that program, but there was about a three-month time frame where they were removing the youth from that and bringing in the adult women. And so for the first 3 months, we spent a lot of time in planning meetings trying to decide and come up with policies and procedures. And it was a pilot project, so we didn't have to follow intensely all the rules and procedures of the prison system. So when we met at these planning meetings, and one of the first meetings that we had, we were talking about how it would unfold. When the women started coming, they would come in shackles and in their orange jumpsuits or and whatever from the prison system to the treatment program, and that we would take the shackles off. And then the superintendent at one point had said, and then we'll take them over and we'll do an unclothed search. And I said, what do you mean you're going to do an unclothed search? What is an unclothed or an unclothed search? Is that a strip search? And at that point, Lieutenant Johnson, well, I'll let you reply.
I explained to her that it is a strip search, but we don't call it that anymore. We call it an unclothed search, but the process is the same. And that really confused Rhonda. She said, you know, so you're putting a nice name on it, but it's a strip search. Basically, I had to say, yeah, that's what we do. And we do this for the safety and security of the facility. So that's one example. But, I mean, her treatment agenda just went against just about every policy or procedure that I'd been trained to uphold. And, you know, those are two questions that we pose in the book. Are security policies and procedures supporting a treatment environment? And are treatment cultures threatening the safety and security of correctional facilities? And in our book, we kind of go through in a dialogue form where you kind of, the reader is a kind of a fly on the wall as the therapist and lieutenant kind of battle their different perspectives. And we just want to bring awareness to how conflicting a treatment culture is and prison policies and procedures. We really need to separate that in America. And I agree with you, every state. As we implement treatment centers and programs to rehabilitate people, reintegrate them back in the community, we need to have these treatment centers that are really a primary treatment culture and environment as opposed to a prison environment.
Right. So when the women came out and we were targeting women who had trauma. We had an assessment process that everybody participated in so that we could, one, make sure that, I mean, my role was to make sure that the women there actually had trauma, and the lieutenant's role and the superintendent's role was to make sure that they weren't going to be violent, you know, or had recent violence to be able to gain entry into the program. We had a nurse there who made sure that the medical needs weren't more than what we could handle at the facility. So we were targeting women who had trauma. And as most people know, women's trauma is most related to sexual abuse, either in childhood or adulthood, rape, you know, that type of stuff. And so we're going to bring these women in who are coming into, from my perspective, a treatment program. And the very first thing we're going to do is traumatize them by forcing them, mandating them to take off their clothes. That is not conducive to treatment in any way, shape, or form. And it was like, no, we're not going to start off treatment by traumatizing. We're not going to start off a trauma treatment program by traumatizing the women who come in there. So right away, we were at odds. And as Lieutenant Johnson had said previously, his role was to make sure that the facility was secure and safe. And he'd had over a decade of training on the craziest training I have ever participated in my life, right? That was another day. And the fact that this program worked is because Lieutenant Johnson and most of the staff, our superintendent and the nurse, were very open, very caring people. So when you, Leona, had said earlier that there are good people and bad people in the correctional facility, I couldn't agree with you more. There are good and bad probation officers. There are good and bad police officers. The fact is there are good and bad people. But I believe that I absolutely landed in a world of very caring, and I was surprised because my coming into that, I had the predetermination that most police officers and guards and prison employees and that whole system were very mean, very authoritative, and not very caring people. And I can tell you that is not the case, and that was not the case at Riverside. But I agree, there are some of those people who exist. I feel like most of the people who are working, at least in the treatment aspect of a prison system, are very caring and good people, but they're trained to do things that are inconclusive or conflicting with treatment. And it's part of the training. So when you talk about how do we fix this in the United States, we have to, you know, recognize that treatment and prison don't belong together.
May I ask something?
I wanted to bring Marion in on that, but real quickly, I wanted to say when Michael mentions, treatment, and I've been trying to let everybody know this. I started a petition about 5 months ago to replace prisons with long-term residential treatment facilities. And I want to talk a little bit more about that later, and I want to get your feedback on it. Because when I say long-term residential treatment facilities, I don't mean like the ones we have in the communities now, you know, 6 months to a year or maybe 2 years maximum. I'm talking about a long-term residential mental health treatment facilities. It can be for 10, 20 years, 25 years. And for those who are so bad or for serial killers or terrorists, they can stay in for as long as it takes, if it takes forever. But if, at least they're getting treatment by professional psychiatrists, psychologists, medical providers, you know, nurses, doctors, even to have guards there. But at least it won't have that hardcore, steel. And this is where Marion, I want her to also explain how the facilities in other countries, in her country, how it's so different than the institutions that we have in this country. But Marion, can you respond to what Rhonda was saying?
Well, I would really like first to ask a question to Michael, if that's possible, because I'm very curious about what is the training for a correctional officer? How does the training look like?
Well, the training here in Montana is very extensive, there's a lot to cover there. But one example is we have like the inmate manipulation training, where officers are trained to understand that an inmate can pretty much just ask you how your day is, and by getting that connection, they can then, you know, manipulate the staff, get them to bring in drugs, get them, just manipulate them. And so when officers are prepared like that, they're basically being taught, keep your distance, you know, keep good, strong boundaries. And in a treatment program, we were also asking the officers to be correctional counselors and have a relationship-based rapport with the residents, as we call them. So the training is very conflicting. On one hand, it's the DOC, the Department of Corrections, is preparing every officer for the worst-case scenario out of every single incarcerated person. And then as we get into treatment, it's, hey, you need to start building trust. You need to trust them. And we really need to separate that, I think, better in this country. Put them in treatment, or I like to say put them in prison or invite them to treatment. And we have to change the culture. But right now our treatment centers are very much still training officers to see and prepare for the worst-case scenario out of every resident.
So the training basically is look at these people not as people, but as a bad person, a person who is going to cause you harm, break the, you know, they almost train, well, I think they do train most people to see them as almost subhuman, right, or a lesser population. There's something wrong with them. And that's not the truth. These are people. They're human beings. They made bad choices, but what I would say from a clinical perspective is they were traumatized, and that trauma, you know, when it affects the vagus nerve in the body, it creates havoc, and most people can't endure that emotional stress and strain and pain, and so they go looking for relief. And fortunately or unfortunately, medication works, and so does street drugs. And then they get into that, and then that leads to crime, and then they end up in prison. Most of the women that I worked with were, like 99% of them were a victim before they ever were a prison or a criminal.
And I say that about the male as well, because I personally, but there are a large portion of males who were victims before becoming offenders too. That's why I tell everyone not to stereotype prisoners, because we have people incarcerated who are wrongfully convicted. We have prisoners who are first-time offenders on under the three strikes law or under nonviolent laws. And then we have prisoners who were victims before becoming offenders. We have so many people in prison, men and women, who were violated as children, who grew up without a father or a mother, who grew up in homes that are that were full of drugs and things like that, crime, and they grew up in that cycle. So, and then there are young people who were misled by other peers, but there are so many people in prison that every circumstance is different. And I think if they're going to have prisons, they should have each prison to house these types, individual types of crime. If they're young people that, you know, committed offenses, gang members, keep them in certain prisons. Keep them separate from the others where they can work on them individually to try to, what's the word they use, Michael, Rhonda, de-something them from the gang?
Well, I am understanding exactly what you're saying, Leona.
I can't think of the word, right?
We think of recidivism?
No,
to address the recidivism?
No, it's to get them out of the gangs. There's a state, and I won't mention the state, but there's a state in the United States that has prisoners, that has gang members who left the gang, and they're in a certain place where they can be protected while at the same time, you know, de-somethingizing them. From gangs. I can't think of the word right now. But that's what it is. We have people in prison who are victims, and they're men and women. Women may have the larger population, you know, of being victimized by, like, domestic violence and things like that. But but there's a large portion of males too. Look at the case with that Melissa Carter, who talked her boyfriend into committing suicide. There are cases like that of people, the same situation. Unfortunately, instead of committing suicide, it turned out to be homicide, which they're in prison. Whereas if they had committed suicide, they would have been totally looked at differently. But these are some of the issues, too, that are happening in these prisons today that have gone unnoticed.
Well, now, and I would agree that a lot of suicides here in Montana, Montana ranks way high and has for several years for suicide. But many of those suicides are related, I think, to incarceration or pending incarceration. And people will, you know, commit suicide 3 days or 2 days before they're supposed to go to jail or prison when they, you know, they may have gone to jail, been picked up, got out, but waiting trial, and then know that the trial's not going to go in their favor and that they're going to have to do some kind of time, and then a lot of people commit suicide. A lot of the of men and women have had trauma, and I think women speak more about trauma, but my belief is that men have just as much, maybe, I would assume, that we're not that different. And but except that men are, you know, are raised to buck up and just tolerate, you know, and they're raised here by society, so to speak, not to speak about the trauma that they've had. But I know that many men have had sexual abuse too. They just don't talk about it as much as women. And
which
so here we're taking victims and we're treating them like criminals right from the get-go.
I think with the,
yeah, but
with the,
I think that is because it's a disciplinary system. The word correctional can mean rehabilitation, but also discipline. People are getting disciplined instead of rehabilitation. So the goal of incarceration is disciplining the people in the incarcerated people instead of rehabilitate them.
And you know, Rhonda mentioned
And another problem is, of course, what is the million-dollar industry around the whole system. Yesterday, I saw a very good documentary about there was the police department in New York. There were 12 policemen who spoke up and who explained how they every day have to get a certain quota of arrests, otherwise they can lose their jobs. And the lobbyists in the White House, they lobby for a certain quota of prisoners in prisons because of the money. So that's
well,
the whole.
In our book, Correcting Treatment, in our book, Correcting Treatment and Corrections, we dove into writing the book because we had Montana, when we implemented this program, and as Lieutenant Johnson had said earlier, it was incredibly successful. We heard from the state itself, they crunch and do all these numbers to see how long people stay out after they've left the program. And our program was one of the highest successful programs that the state of Montana has seen. And so abruptly we were shut down. Just absolutely closed, and it made no sense. Why would they take a win-win-win? It was a win for the women coming through there. It was a win for the taxpayers because we had a shorter program, and it was three times almost successful than previous programs, and they abruptly closed it. And that's, we wanted to find out why. Right, we were very incensed about that. So we started doing some research and learned that, you know, the state of Montana has contracts with these facilities that call themselves a treatment program but are often run under the same policies and procedures as a prison system. And that part of those contracts, one, the contracts last 20 years, And so that in and of itself, you can't make any, you know, if you have a contract that lasts 20 years, most governors here don't stick around for 20 years.
It
ties the hands of the governor. It ties the hands of the director. And what you end up having is you have these treatment facilities running the prison system, really. And the state of Montana is paying for bed space because in those contracts, they're paying 75% of bed space, whether there's a person in there or not. And what we found out is that because our program was so successful that those treatment facilities that are contracted weren't getting the referrals that they needed.
Yeah.
And so the pressure was on, hey, you have a, you know, so you're going to pay for this regardless.
I think if the treatment is successful for the prisoners, then it's a failure for the corporation. There are two agendas.
Miriam, you are exactly right, because what we found out here is that the state of Montana operates its prison system much like you would operate a business. But
yes.
You can't operate a business when you are involving human lives that don't have a choice, right?
It's like bioindustry. I don't know if that's the correct word in English. It has elements of concentration camps because, you know, for these corporations, they don't look at human beings. They say there are 2.2 million inmates, the label inmates. They don't talk about
right.
2.2 million human beings. You know,
right.
if you look at the drug problem, they see it as a crime instead of a problem that has to be treated. If you would take everybody out of the prison who has a psychological problem or a drug addiction or need other help, you have only a very small amount of people who are really in there because they only commit the crime and do have to do the time. I believe that the biggest part of the incarcerated people has a drug and has a psychological problem. But, you know, I don't know if it was in the 60s or in the 70s, but I was in the time that they developed medication for psychological problems like lithium for depression. And then they closed all the psychiatric hospitals. So these people, they ended up in the streets with medication. And in the end, they all ended up in the prisons.
That's
doing business. You know, this is purely doing business. And that's a painful thing.
I'd like to bring two things up, and then, and Michael, I'm sorry, the women are taking over, but we're going to give you back some time. I'd like to bring up two subjects. Rhonda, you had mentioned most prisoners commit suicide when they're waiting for court and all this, but I wanted to say solitary confinement is a serious issue, and we've had a lot of suicides right here in Massachusetts in the prisons, and solitary confinement is, and I just understand New York, I believe it is, they call it the halt, where they're actually, some senators, they actually signed some bills or something to eliminate solitary confinement. That's been a major problem. And the other issue I wanted to bring to raise was when you were talking about women talking about their traumas that happened when they were children, we all know that men, all men, have been taught, I think, from the beginning to be strong, you know, to not to cry, not to do these things. And there's a lot of men throughout the years and throughout the nation who have had things happen to them where they have not told anyone about it. And it could be more than one from the time they were children to adolescence to adult. They haven't talked about it. And then one thing can come up, one major thing can come up, and it can throw them right completely off. And a lot of them, and I've been working with the nation as well as the state, but a lot of them have held it in until they couldn't hold it in anymore. And then they end up going in, either going into depression or abruptly doing something that they regret. But a lot of times they go into depression. When they go into depression, they stop eating, they stop sleeping, they stop doing everything. They can't, they let their guard down. They can't do anything. A lot of these things are issues that people don't even realize, but men have always been taught, and Michael can confirm this because I'm sure it's the same with him. I went to a prison one time, and they had these prisoners who were soon to be released. They were out doing work duty out in the yard or someplace in the community, and they were in the waiting room. And I said to them, some of them, I said, "Why do you look so mean, so angry?" He said that that's the way they have to be when they're in the prison. They have to look tough, because if they don't look tough, if they don't play the role, they can be prey to other prisoners or to prison employees. So that's what they look evil, or they try to look evil, so that they're not going to be preyed upon. Medication. Prisoners have said, a lot of them that have not taken medication while incarcerated, has said they don't take medication because sometimes they are given so much medication they walk around like zombies, again becoming prey to others. And these are some of the issues that I have gotten from prisoners, and it's you know, it's just something I wanted to bring out, because we now as women we're getting more independent, and we're able to do a lot of the same work that the males are doing. But at the same time, males still have that mentality that they have to be strong, and they have to look strong, and they have to look like they are definitely going to defend themselves. And I will let you, all three of you, take over.
Well, I would absolutely agree with you that it's necessary, especially for male inmates, to put on a front where they're not weak, they're not vulnerable, and absolutely, it's necessary in order for them not to get bullied or preyed upon.
So one of the things that we learned when we were writing the book, we did a ton of research. Every bit of it is people can go and look at the newspaper articles. I mean, what we wrote in this book, it's nonfiction. It's absolutely the truth. But one of them, and I would like Lieutenant Johnson to talk about the top 10 crimes and what we found out about those here in Montana. And I know that this might differ from state to state, but in Montana, we wrote about what the top 10 crimes were as far as people going into prison.
Right, and the majority, it was very interesting because in comparison for males and females in Montana, most of your crimes, the top 10, are criminal possession with the intent to distribute or criminal possession of dangerous drugs. What we found was that there was no murder. There were no sex crimes. It was really pretty much just possession of drugs. So we have this larger majority of incarcerated people here that really need treatment more than anything, mental health and addiction treatment. And the program that we worked in, by addressing the trauma, it was just amazing to me how when the women would get the trauma treatment from Ms. Champagne, the therapist, and throughout the program, they stopped becoming victims to what happened to them. And I really watched them get stronger mentally, physically, emotionally. It was amazing. And that's why the program was so successful, is that we sent them out, we empowered them, we strengthened them back up. I think a lot of our correctional treatment centers break them down and don't do a real good job of building them back up. When you send these people back into the community, we need them to be confident. We need them to feel like they can change their lives for the better. And our treatment centers fall short of that, especially when we're doing strip searches and we're treating them like inmates, which is all about power and control and kind of defeating the population. Treatment should be about building them up. That's what we did there. And after you know, hearing about some of the things these women have been through, it just broke my heart. And I think in the prison system, officers are taught to, you know, again, keep that that boundary up between them and not really get to know them. In this treatment center that we did, we had a relationship-based rapport, and as the officers got to know these women, I noticed the women had more respect for the officers. We call them correctional counselors. And the correctional counselors had more respect for the women. And it was something special. It changed my life. I couldn't see the incarcerated population the same anymore.
But
and
is your program shut down, or is it still working? Are you still...
It got shut down. The other issue, I think, with America is these nonprofit private organizations that have moved into corrections in a really big way. Mm-hmm. And so what we found is that the referrals to our program were taking away referrals from the nonprofit organizations. And they had contracts with the government here in Montana. And those contracts stipulated that 75% of the bed space at those treatment facilities would be paid regardless of whether or not a person was in the bed or not. So when their referrals dropped down, Montana was paying for empty bed space. And that constitutes a
conflict of interest.
Wasteful money. So really the system with the nonprofit organizations, the problems is that it's being run off a business model.
Yeah.
So the primary objective is just to fill bed space, regardless, instead of a risk and needs assessment, putting people in there because they need the treatment.
Yeah, that's a big problem, the business model, yes.
Right, and what you find out is in Montana there's about 5 different contracted treatment facilities. They hire most of the time it's a brand new licensed clinical social worker or licensed addiction counselor, and put them on the payroll and say they're providing treatment, but they're not training them to provide treatment. They're training them to provide more prison space. And I think that what happened in the United States, I mean, we are the number, I think we are number one in incarcerating people. And I find this just like absolutely mind-boggling to me, because we're called the land of the free, right?
You are the land of the incarcerated.
Right. But I think the biggest thing that worked in the program that we talked about was what Lieutenant Johnson was talking about a little bit earlier, and maybe he can define the difference, but we did not have officers. We had correctional counselors. And, you know, I talked to a correctional counselor in California, and their role was entirely different than what we did here. And like Lieutenant Johnson was saying, we developed a relationship-based rapport. When I first got there, I mean, we had actually some pretty hilarious and some pretty, you know, funny interactions and arguments or battles, so to speak, over different philosophies. And, you know, Lieutenant Johnson and all of his staff were really good people and doing what they were trained to do. But the idea of what happens in a prison, you know, I mean, if somebody's in prison, and I'm not going to speak about prison because that's not my forte. My forte is treatment. But if somebody is in a prison system, whatever rules they have, I don't want to get into that. But when you decide that you're going to call yourself a treatment program, that's where I will jump in and say, okay, this is what I know to be treatment. And the policies and procedures of a prison cannot be conducive to a trauma-informed treatment program, particularly when the policies say you're going to strip search everybody that comes in and you're going to, you know, do all of these things that are just absolutely in opposition to treatment. But when we started talking about that, and because Lieutenant Johnson and his staff and the superintendent and everybody who operated at the Riverside Treatment Program, they were very open-minded and willing. But there was a specific day that I went into Lieutenant Johnson's office and said, you know, can I connect with you? Because if you and your staff can't understand this and get on board with the treatment program, it's going to fail. You're not going to have treatment if you're running it like you were the prison. And I want to let him reply to what the conversation we had that day.
Basically, I told her, all right, I'm going to be completely honest with you. I think what you're doing is really dangerous. I think, you know, empowering the incarcerated population, we call them residents, to the level that she wanted to empower them, was going to get somebody hurt. You know, I was very much about, we need rules, we need consequences, we need to control the situation, you know, all the inmates. And I kind of told her, you're going to get somebody hurt. But I told her, it's not going to be because myself or my officers do something to make that happen. I told her, we're going to do this your way. We're going to do trauma-informed, even though it goes against, like, almost every policy and procedure I've got. And it was kind of an eye-opening conversation between the two of us. But what I found out was that I was wrong. Bottom line, I was wrong. And as I really watched this program develop and I watched the officers become counselors and they were running groups and they were providing one-on-one treatments and building relationships with the residents there, the women, we never had a violent outburst. We never had a fight. We never had any of the things that the Department of Corrections really prepares me for and basically through the training says, this is going to happen. You know, people are going to get hurt. But when we built that relationship-based rapport and we really lifted up the women and we empowered them, the security, they took care of themselves. You know, they have so much value and respect for the program and for what we were doing and the officers. We never had any problems. You know, the system that we have right now.
You see what happened, though? It worked, and you see what happened. You said it's no longer working. I mean, it's no longer existing. Everything that works, for some reason, gets closed down or gets, you know, it's sad because if it was working, it should still be not only still be implemented and going on in Montana, but it should be around the country in all the states. That program,
and what you're talking about, I had one of the women that came in, first 10 women that came in the program was very guarded because of the way we were running things. And she could not believe that, you know, we made eye contact, we shook their hand, we talked to them, we treated them as they are a human being, right? Not a subhuman being and not a criminal. We saw them as people. We treated them as people. And she said, I cannot believe that this place is real. Am I dreaming or, you know, is this a real place? And if it is real, they're going to shut you down. And I can remember looking at her like, what? You know, she said, oh, yeah, you'll never last. I'm so glad I'm here now, right? And I did not believe her. Like, I didn't understand that. But sure enough, they did.
You know,
and I don't know.
I received a call from a prisoner in Pennsylvania the other day, and he was asking if I knew anything about these politicians going to Norway, some politicians in this country going to Norway to see how they operate their system, because Norway is considered the role model for all prisons throughout the world. And so I had heard something about it. I'm not sure who's going out, how many, or what, but I know even some of the people in this state of Massachusetts visited some of those prisons. I believe it was in Germany. I'm not sure. But they're now starting to go to these countries to look things over. And with that said, and with the program that you and Michael were involved in, I think if they pull all these positive things together, we could have a role model in this country of prison reform and prisoners being healed and treated like the ones you're talking about now.
Well, one of the things that our book will show in there is it's almost a step-by-step program. When you read the book, you'll see that it's almost a step-by-step program of how to implement trauma-informed treatment in an empowering way using SAMHSA guidelines. And SAMHSA is Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, a federal oversight agency. And that, what I love about SAMHSA is they pull everybody. They pull everybody, whatever topic they're addressing. They will pull all the stakeholders, the people themselves, and their family members, as well as systems and people in government and people, in charge of different systems. And they'll get a whole a very well-rounded outlook on what works, and then they boil down and then they develop guidelines. I would like to see in the United States that those guidelines become law, because if they did, they would have to change dramatically the way, not what they're doing, but how they're doing what they're doing. And, it just goes back to very basic human nature. If you are told day in and day out, 24 hours a day, and told, Miriam, you had mentioned this a little bit earlier about the language that we use, we call them inmates, we don't call them people. Trauma-informed care says we call them by their name. We address them by their name. They are people. We make eye contact with them. We sit down and we work together. And what Lieutenant Johnson did on the unit was where it worked. Because you can't take a group of people, put them in a treatment program for an hour twice a week and say you're providing treatment. In a treatment facility, treatment happens 24/7.
Yes.
And so... Many of the treatment, so-called treatment places within corrections, it isn't a 24-hour treatment facility. It's a two-hour or one-hour twice a week, or some kind of class. That might be a self-help thing. That might help people learn some basic skills about stuff. But that's not treatment. Treatment happens all day long, all night long,
and in another environment.
Exactly.
Because even the building is built to discipline. It's designed to discipline. And the uniforms, the inmate uniforms, which labels them, from day one, they have to give up their authentic being, and they put on the code of discipline.
Right, and our systems
Sound is getting worse. Yeah, hello?
Are you able to hear Miriam?
Yes, but yeah.
Okay.
I would agree with you. I think a lot of their treatment centers really push a self-discipline type approach, thinking that, what you got to do is beat it into their heads that what they've done is wrong and they need to make a better choice. But the problem with that is that the power and control approach, that self-discipline, it only lasts as long as you are in that environment where mm-hmm. you've got officers and you've got that control factor. So once they move out of that and come back in the community, they haven't really learned any kind of self-discipline. Self-discipline comes from empowerment. And if we had treatment centers that really empowered the residents more, they would be more prepared to go out in the community and then self-discipline themselves.
Yeah.
Right now, we're treating it like a boot camp or the military. And,
yes.
and in the military, you go through the boot camp, and there's that power and control, And yeah, those guys learn and those women learn how to self-discipline themselves when they're being given orders. But then they come out of boot camp and they're still in the military, so they're still getting the orders. The power and control is still there. In corrections, I think they're trying to mirror that in a lot of ways, and they want to run a boot camp type disciplinary program. But the problem is when they go back into the community, that power and control is no longer there. So it's not the same as the military.
And I think it's even more devastating because at the moment that somebody commits a crime in the street, he hasn't had any responsibilities. So something in his life went wrong, and that's why he could commit a crime. And at that moment, he had no responsibility. And then he ends up in the prison system where he also has no responsibility. He doesn't learn anything.
You're exactly right, Miriam. And
so,
when,
you know, when there are guards, sometimes I read these articles, and when there are guards in the prison system who abuse their power, then they commit the same crime on inmates, but then they get not punished. It's like a rule reversal sometimes, you know, and that
makes it sometimes
confusing.
Well, not just confusing, Miriam, but I would say that it builds up such a resentment that people then despise. I mean, they get very angry with the way the system is run here. A lot of people coming out of prison here in Montana will go right to a probation officer, and they're taught and trained. And I have met some incredibly good-hearted, wonderful probation officers. But their training and their, you know,
yeah,
that's what needs to change. Their training is like fill them up, make them go to, you know, 6 or 7 AA meetings a week, plus they're going to meet with the probation officer weekly, plus they got to do a mental health weekly, plus they got to go to a licensed addiction counselor, plus they got to get a job, but they can't drive because they've lost their driver's license. And they have,
they
pile it on.
Yeah,
and people get very frustrated, and then they just say, I'm going to leave. I'm not going to tolerate this anymore, or I'll go back to prison because exactly what you said, it's easier. They don't have the responsibility. They don't have the value. Now, I know that some prisons here in Montana are creating some value, some, you know, some work stuff, but when they're getting paid, you know, 15 cents an hour or 25 cents an hour to do all this work, that doesn't provide any value. I mean, I would rather see them pay for their stay in prison and earn a decent wage or the same wage that they would be getting if they were on the outside, right? And then paying for, you know, their meals or whatever, because that would provide some sense of empowerment. I mean, we didn't get that far in the treatment program that we ran, but what we did was we worked on just the integral part of trauma. We had, and I think Lieutenant Johnson can talk about the effects of our gratitude circle. That was one of the very first and last things that we implemented on a daily basis was a gratitude circle. And it wasn't just the residents or inmates, you know, doing it. It was the residents and all the staff. And everybody participated and could participate in that gratitude circle. And I'll let Mr. Johnson tell you about the effects of that, the outcome.
The gratitude circle I found to be very influential for their relationship-based rapport. They had gratitude circle first thing in the morning and right before bed, so twice a day. And really, it was a simple group. The women were just asked, what are you grateful for? And they would list off a few things. But the staff, the correctional counselors, would also involve themselves, and they would list off what they're grateful for, you know, their kids, their health, the sunrise. It could be anything. And what I noticed was that before long, what I started to hear was a resident say that they were grateful for an officer. or an officer said they were grateful for a resident. And there again, it really created a relationship-based rapport of respect and gratitude amongst officers and residents. It was pretty powerful.
Yeah, it's meeting the human being behind the crime.
Absolutely.
I think that's the foundation of all. That's
Absolutely.
What I do in my work, too.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, any one of us, if we were treated horribly, I mean, if you put me in a cage and put me out in the middle of the street somewhere and everybody who walked by threw dirt at me or spit on me, it's only going to be a matter of time before I spit back and throw. You know what I'm saying? If you're if you're trained or taught vicariously by not even being called your name, but given a number instead, made to wear the same clothes as everybody else, so you take away your personal identity differences.
Yeah.
All those things say there's something wrong with you, something wrong with you, something wrong with you. We need to start looking at what's right with people and building on that instead of focusing on the wrongs. When you're talking about treatment, that's what we need to do. We need to meet all people as unique individuals. Our system here in the States does not allow, even our court system, I mean, they run it through, if you went to court on Monday morning here in Montana, you would see 20 or 25 or whoever, got in trouble over the weekend, all chained up together, ran to the court system. They're all there all at once. Nobody gets to speak. Nobody gets to say, hey, my case is a little bit different. Can I tell you my story? Can I tell you what happened? No, that never happens. And their court-appointed attorneys are so overwhelmed, they oftentimes don't even meet with their clients until like 8 minutes before the court. And so nowhere does the human being get to say, wait a second, I want to tell you what happened. And they need that, right? They need to start addressing that. When we do trainings and stuff, both Lieutenant Johnson and I do trainings on trauma-informed care. And when we do that, I talk about going into, if you have trauma, if you just say, all right, your average person goes out on a picnic and you take the people that you love with you and you're going to go on a hike and, you check the weather, everybody decides we're all going to bring our own backpack and everybody's going to bring their own sandwich or their medications or whatever it is that they need in their own backpack. We're going to go. The weather's supposed to be good. You start going and then you notice some clouds rolling in and let's just say that you tell the group of people that you're with, hey, I know a shortcut to get to our picnic area, but we got to cross the river. But, only just a little bit below your knees, so it should be pretty safe. And so everybody agrees, and you start crossing the river, and all of a sudden you're hit with a flash flood, right? And it knocks you off your feet. And as you're falling backwards, you feel your backpack come off of you. And by the time you get up above the mud and the debris and everything and you look around, you don't see anybody at all. There's nobody around you. And you are absolutely just in the water trying to figure out where's my son, where's my mother, where's my girlfriend or my wife or all these people that you love, and you can't find anybody. And you're stuck in a raging river. The very first thing that you need to do is to get to dry ground so that you can breathe and know that you're safe. Physical safety is number one. And psychological safety is also number one. And this is where the correctional system and treatment systems don't get congruent because, the security aspect is, we'll keep you physically safe, right, by any means, power and control or whatever. But they don't acknowledge psychological safety. So you have a person, all right, they might be on dry ground now. That's that physical piece. But they don't know where their kid is. They don't know where their mom is. They don't have their backpack. And, you know, they're just stuck there trying to figure out where is my family. Well, our system keeps people in the river that way, you know, or at best it gets them on dry ground, but there's no support system around them.
Yeah.
And nobody, you know, the person who's struggling with the trauma can't even begin to heal, can't even start that healing process until they have both physical and psychological safety. And so our system needs to look at basic human nature and how trauma affects a person and how it affects the body, the mind, and the urge to get away from those very intense feelings, right? We are not meant to just endure that kind of trauma for a long period of time. Our systems here, they, in my opinion, the sentencings that people get are too long. They're often, you know, you take a young 23, 25-year-old kid who's had a horrific trauma in their history. They get involved in a crime, and then one of the first things that happens is they end up in a prison cell with people who've been in there for 10 years, who've had to change, you know, like Miriam, I think you were talking about, Leona, I think you said that when people try to dress up and look really mean, and you know, that's a protective nature, a protective thing that people do so that they don't become a victim of somebody else. And in our system, you know, they keep people in that psychological state of trauma, and there's no psychological safety, and so therefore there's no physical safety, and so we do things to get away from that intense feeling, and often that's drugs, right? It takes away the feeling for the moment, right? It adds a lot of problems later on, but it takes away that feeling for the moment, and so for a split second you can have that sense of safety, and then you have all these other problems that come along with it. I mean,
you know
that,
what I find too with the drugs. Another thing is, are these addictions? We have an epidemic, like both you and Michael were saying earlier. We have an epidemic in this country of mental illnesses and addictions. Now, addictions, actually, a lot of people, there might be people that love to take it, you know, from the beginning, but there's also a lot who have been became addicted through medication, through the doctor, pain medication, all kinds of medications that have caused. Also, there's a lot of people who are addicted who have been doing drugs because of some trauma that happened in their lives, and they're trying to block it out. And the best way to block it out is through alcohol or some form of drugs. But real quickly, I just wanted to ask all three of you. We have a pandemic which started around March, April of last year. When we talk about the mental health status or the trauma right now, these prisoners, a lot of them are being kept detained in their cells for 22 hours a day. It's been since the pandemic. They're let out of their cell 14 hours a week. What are your thoughts on the mental state, the damage that's being done to these prisoners psychologically to be in these cells? A lot of them with none of their belongings or very little of their belongings, no connection to the outside world. Their televisions have been taken from them. What are your thoughts on the damages that are being done to them psychologically? And I disagree that they should even be in 22 hours a day.
I agree with you, Leona. But if you look at the world right now. The world is in this pandemic, and I'm talking now about the people who are not incarcerated but are at home. The world has been traumatized by COVID-19 and its effects. And so people, you know, they're stuck in their homes, and they're frustrated with that. They're with their family members in their home. They got a television. You know, they're worried about food and toilet paper, as we all know, and different things like that. But they're still being very traumatized. And I can tell you from my private practice, and you try to find a therapist, it's very difficult here because everybody's so packed because people are coming into therapy from that. Now, then you take the incarcerated person who's in a cell that's enduring that too and has no choice to, you know, go outside or even social distance. They can't keep those numbers, you know, 6 feet apart and all of that stuff. And I mean, so they do. They stick, you know, the same 4, 8 or however many people in a cell and keep them in there. So it's tenfold the trauma that's going on in incarceration. And I think the world knows how much COVID has messed with people free. I can't imagine the psychological duress and stress that would happen from people who are incarcerated with this pandemic going on.
Because they are in fact in solitary confinement all the time.
Yeah. So Michael and Rhonda, you want to talk a little bit about the book now? I mean, the treatment that you've been doing and the book, and also if you can let the audience know, you know, where they can find the book. If you have a website, Mariam as well, to let the audience know where they can get in contact with you or go to your website or whatever. And then maybe before the show ends, you can repeat it again.
Sure. We have a website called correctingtreatment.com. And that website will take you to an Amazon link where you can purchase the book. You can also just go on Amazon and then put correcting treatment in corrections, and you can read the reviews from people that have purchased the book.
It's sold all over the place. You get it at Barnes & Noble and just about anywhere. But if you Google correctingtreatment.com, that's like Lieutenant said, that's our website. There are also testimonies from the women who had gone through our program. There's about 30 plus testimonies out of their own mouth what they felt about the program. It would be a great inside look at how the women felt that the program worked for them.
Okay, I just typed in correcting treatments and corrections, and all of it came up. So they don't have to do WW or anything. Corrections, treatment, corrections. Okay.
Right.
Mariam, do you want to talk about yours as well?
Yes, well, I am still writing the book, so it cannot be bought yet. But in my book, I try to deconstruct in a way or analyze the prison system, mass incarceration, how it's embedded in social aspects, political and economical aspects, because our system is a mirror of society, and that's also with the prison system. So what I see in the prison system reflects elements of society. And I do that to try to contribute to awareness, like how is it possible that we have an 8th Amendment and at the same time people are sometimes tortured in prison without consequences? How is it possible that in the 50s it was already proven that solitary confinement longer than 15 days is devastating, and you know, how is it possible then that people are in solitary confinement for months or even years? And I try to do that from a neutral position, not from an emotional position, but just look at what is going on and how are things connected to each other. And that's in fact the same as what I do with incarcerated people here in the Netherlands, that I look at the human being behind the crime. And together we try to deconstruct the web of influence that led to the crime. So in fact, that's the same procedure that I now apply to the whole system. But I'm still in the middle of the writing process yet and research process.
You know, actually, if you type in Mariam Jacobs on the internet, Mariam Jacobs, everything will come up on Mariam. If you type in Michael Johnson and Rhonda Champagne, just type their names in on the internet book, everything will come up on them. If you didn't get it, you can listen to the show again after and get the information all over again. And back to the treatment, the treatment that's been going on, Michael, Rhonda, do you plan to at some point in time try to get this program up again that you had initially started, either inside or outside of the penal system?
Well, absolutely. That's what everything in the book is about. We're advocates for trauma-informed treatment for incarcerated populations, both men and women, to reduce recidivism, to reintegrate people successfully back in the communities. It's a bipartisan thing. It doesn't matter if you're Democrat or Republican.
Mm-hmm.
We spend millions and millions of dollars on the Department of Corrections and housing people, and our treatment is ineffective. The recidivism rates are extremely high. So it's really time, I think, for America to understand that corrections as an organization has been evolving over time, right? And, I mean, it was just 100 years ago, 50 years ago, that we were still using the pillory post, and we were whipping inmates in order to, back then they believed that that was an effective way to reform the inmates. And we look back on that now and we can see that was nothing more than abuse. It's time now for America to really look at the way we are incarcerating people and the treatment that we're providing, and the fact that it's ineffective in the sense that we're not helping people come back in the community, be successful, productive members of the community. We have to start doing something different. And trauma-informed treatment is, I believe, absolutely what is needed. By getting these people to understand what they've been through, understand how it affects their choices, understand how it affects addiction, their criminal behavior, this is how we get them back into the community successfully, and everybody should want that.
When we look at the book, and as you're going through the chapters, we added humor because we found humor. That was probably one of the connecting points between treatment and security. But as you go through the book, there's some really funny chapters. I mean, you look at the title and you say Correcting Treatment and Corrections, and a lot of people will think, oh, this is going to be kind of a classroom, lots of statistics and that kind of stuff. But the book really isn't. It's a dialogue kind of form. We had a lot of fun with it. So it takes you through a roller coaster ride of emotions. There's a story in there when the lieutenant came into my office. I was brand new in there, and like I said, I didn't know a whole lot about security and prison, and believed that it was all running the way it was supposed to until I got in there. But the superintendent had said, "This is your office, you know, decorate it, make it your home," kind of thing. I took him literally, so I brought in all kinds of stuff that made it look like a homey atmosphere, and then Lieutenant Johnson came in. I'll let him tell you about what he thought.
Well, the bottom line was, I told her that this office was a crime scene waiting to happen. She had all kinds of glass vases, decorative sticks, crystals that were the size of a softball that she was going to let the residents, you know, handle when they were upset or angry. And from a correction standpoint, all the training that I had, I'm like, oh my God, somebody's going to get killed in this office. And of course, it turned out that no one abused anything in that office, and that, you know, everything that she had in there was used for a treatment level. But there again, it's an example of how the policies and procedures from a correctional, a militarized organization, just we really don't understand what's needed for treatment. And everything that she was using in treatment, to me, was a weapon. I mean, yeah.
Oh, I remember him saying, what is this bowl of pens doing on your table? Is this where you're going to hold groups with the women? And I said, yeah. Well, why do you have all those pens? I'm like, because I have enough pens for the women to use. And he says, you have enough pens for everybody to get a full body tattoo in here. But it was so different. And, you know, the book kind of takes you through that. The book also takes you through some very connecting human elements. We talked about trauma. We have a caution to the reader. We don't get into the vulgarities of what happened. And, you know, we don't use cuss words in the book because we do want it to be an educational tool. We would absolutely love it to get in the education system here, particularly for anybody who's a licensed addictions counselor or a licensed therapist or going to be a therapist or a correctional officer or even a debate class, right? Because it goes back and forth and it shows you the unfolding. But there are stories of trauma in there that are, you know, I hold confidentiality high. So, you know, there's not information about who specifically, unless the women wrote that in their testimony, you might be able to figure out some things. But the book is written in a way that would help your average person really kind of understand the women. And I don't think it would be any different for the men. But in the book, there's some specific things. And I'll tell you that if any one of those things would have happened to me, I would probably land in prison too, because I would probably respond exactly like those women responded, because it's our human nature to respond to trauma that way. You know, we respond in ways, you know, that we wouldn't if we didn't have trauma. And a lot of the trauma that occurred on these women was no fault of their own. Again, I will tell you that most of the women there were a victim before they were ever a criminal, and they were a victim by either a car accident that maybe they were driving and they killed their child, and they didn't know how to live with themselves after that, so they started drinking or using drugs, and then that landed them in prison. Or they were raped or molested or sold for drugs by, you know, some. I mean, they're just the stories are in there. The healing is in there. The aspects, each individual aspect. We used positive psychology techniques. We did a full, you know, body, mind, spirit program. So they had exercise, they could lift weights, they could do yoga, they did meditation, just a whole bunch of things that said, these are people and this is what we do when we're trying to cope with different things. You know, there's other ways to cope than drugs. And so we brought in a lot of that type of training in there. I just think the book is a good read. We haven't had anybody read it and say it's junk, right? Most people say, wow, I had no idea that it was going to be such a good book, and we should be doing that all over the place.
I think it has a good title, because when I first saw the title, Correcting Treatment in Corrections, the first thing that came to my mind was the treatment is not working in corrections, so they're correcting that treatment by doing it a different way. And I hope and pray that you and Michael do something with the program that you had. I hope you do something with it, even on the outside, because if there was a proposal written to have prisoners released, you know, nonviolent maybe to start off with, to have prisoners released to treatment programs like the ones that you and Michael are talking about, and having others like involved, like with Miriam Jacobs and others who are seriously trying to correct the treatments that have not worked. These programs would work, and maybe they would start to replace a lot of these. The recidivism rate would definitely be lowered, and people would, it would be a preventative program as well as a program to transition from prison to the into society again. So I hope you seriously consider that, and I would love to have you back on the show at a later date to maybe to just to give us an update on how things are going. And we have about 4 minutes left, 4.5 minutes left, so I'd like to have all three of you maybe give some last-minute statements before we do close. And why don't we start with...
I just want to say thank you very much for having us, you know, talk with you. And hopefully people out there are going to get behind trauma-informed treatment and really, really realize that it's time for our correctional systems and our organizations to evolve and change. We've really been stuck in a place where they just continue to do the same kind of treatments and they're not acknowledging that the recidivism rates are extremely high. So it's time now, and people need to get behind this, you know. That's really what it's about for me.
And I think, Michael, that's exactly the way I feel. That's the way many advocates and even some politicians, many politicians across the country are looking at right now changes because it's not working, as you say. The recidivism rate is high. The sentencing is life and life without. I have interviewed clients, prisoners, who have gotten 3 life sentences. I mean, what kind of mentality is that to get 3 life sentences when you're not, you're lucky if you make it 100. It just doesn't make sense.
Right. Leona, I would like to say again, thank you for having us on the show. And Miriam, I would so love to connect with you and see how things are run in your country, because I would love to expand what we did. We'd absolutely love to bring trauma-informed treatment to every prison in the United States. And I think it's going to take, like Mr. Johnson had said, it's going to take a mass amount of people to scream. It's a big, huge system that we're trying to challenge. And the last thing I would like to say is, as a human species, I hope that when we look at what we've done and we see that it's been wrong, that we can correct it, that we're not so egotistical that we just run with it because we don't want to admit that it wasn't right.
Exactly. So, Miriam, I can give her, if you want, I can give her your contact information, or you can email.
Yeah.
I'll give her your email, and you can email one another with all the details.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that we can exchange our own experiences from the countries, but also our views on this whole subject. Yes, I would like to. So, thank you. And we have to keep fighting for all these people who are incarcerated. And we have to really, really become aware that we are not talking about a label inmate, but 2.2 million beautiful human beings behind all these crimes.
Absolutely.
The prison wall is more or less an illusion. And we have to break it down. We don't need prisons. Small-scale detention. I will talk about with you guys about it.
I thank you all so much for being on. This has been an interesting show, and I will send Miriam, Michael, and Rhonda, I will send you an email with the email contacts. And once you get together with your emails, you can work out the other details. I want to thank the audience for listening in. Again, I want to have all three of you back on at a later time. If you can just let me know when you're available and we get some updates. And I think what you're doing, Michael and Rhonda, excellent correcting treatment and corrections. So I thank you once again. And audience, we are now going to be closing Sunday afternoon at 3:30 in the afternoon. Eastern Time will be interviewing Lawrence Drank and Jerome Eubanks, who will be talking about their experiences in and out of the penal system. Thanks again, guys. It's been nice having you on, and I wish you luck, and I hope you do continue with your treatment.
Thank you, Leona.
Thanks so much, Leona. Michael, Marion, thank you so much. This has been a blessing. We are now going to
Leona.